What's up? Welcome to a new episode of Movie Schmovie. This is episode number 406, also known as 406. My name's Steve, I'm one of the co-hosts, and as always, I'm joined by...
Your call has been... I don't know. My name's Ron.
I thought you hung up on us for a second.
And I'm John, a Danish actor playing an American policeman. And this is the way that we talk.
Interesting. Interesting.
Yeah, I like that. I like that choice.
Jesus is my favorite person. I follow the teachings of Jesus Christ. Like all good Americans.
Yes. Is that how he talks?
Yes.
I don't know. Yeah.
I have like that joke, you know, that joke that I put on like recently where like when I was in London, like there's like a noticeable, if you really pay attention to the cadence, it's very strange. It's not an American cadence. It's like just not here. That's all it sounds like. Just not where you were before and just not here. It's just like, can it be Canadian? I can't figure out what it is. I'm like, what is this thing that they're doing?
Interesting. Okay, we'll get to that in a second. Yeah. So welcome back to the pod. This episode, in a moment here, we're going to get into my pick for required viewing, which is God is a Bullet. And then we're going to talk a little bit about the Oscars, a little recap briefly. And then we'll get into a conversation about the start of a new series on Apple TV Plus called Manhunt that just came out with its first two episodes this last week. So... let's get started. Anything else you guys want to mention before we get into the required viewing or anything on your mind?
Oh, actually, yeah, there's a bit of follow-up that I think we need to address.
Okay.
One is just Dune business. I'm now reading Dune Messiah, the sequel.
Oh.
So I'll be all in the know about what's supposed to be in the next movie in like 6 years or whenever we get that. But I could just tell you, if you're wondering, I've heard this book gets crazy. There's, you know, opinions about the Dune books are so all over the place when you ask people. And so many people say, oh, yeah, the second one's pretty good or pretty interesting. And then other people say, oh, the books are all horrible. And the second one is the craziest one. I don't know. I haven't gotten into the book yet, but I wanted to tell you, if you're looking for a little bit of crazy, in the introduction, Brian Herbert, Frank Herbert's son, the guy who created Dune, and his son writes introductions to a lot of his books and also has written co-written books in carrying on the stories. In the introduction, he compares JFK to Adolf Hitler and claims that if his dad had turned to politics instead of literature, he would have been one of our greatest presidents. But that he's actually glad that instead he wrote science fiction novels rather than like curing America of all of its social ills. So that's just the introduction. That's just five pages, and that's not even the book yet. So it might be crazy. But Ronald, the other part of our Dune report, I wanted to ask you, now that you've seen Dune Part 2, what part do you think was the part that got Steve dancing in his seat and moving forward and leaning on his hands and everything? What scene, what moment, what do you think was the part that had Steve beside himself?
Yeah, I'm thinking about two parts, but I'm thinking it has to be the worm, right? Like, or the...
When Timothy Chalamet does the worm, when he jumps on the ground and does the worm. Yes, that's right.
Yeah. Ding ding ding. Yeah. You got it.
No, when he gets atop the worm.
Yeah.
Yes.
It's filmed like the way that like Superman first starts flying. Like when, you know, or like when Spider-Man learns how to first swing for the first time. Like it's just such a weirdly visceral, I can't wait. This, out of the two movies, I think I'm more excited to listen to this one at home. Like, it's way more sounds. Like, I you know, there's very little lulls in between. Like, it's all action. It's all great sound.
It's a broader spectrum of stuff too. It still has the quiet moments, but it's got also craziness and
tons
it's got
of action.
Like a little bit of more time spent in kind of like the alternate world sort of the Harkonnen, you know, family seat. Is it Gaidi Prime or Gaidi Prime?
Gaidi Prime, yeah.
Gaidi Prime,
I don't know how I handled Christopher Walken just talking in that world. Arrakis.
I thought he was going to bump me more than he did. He still had a couple of words where that, no, but he still has a couple of Bronx moments, you know. But I thought he was going to bump me way more than he did. But I thought he was like good. I think that it's like he's one of those actors who's going to, I feel like the same risk is run if you bring like Nicolas Cage into a movie. There's there's going to be the possibility of brilliance, but there's also going to be a couple of moments where you're like, yeah, no one would say that word that way except for Nicolas Cage. And there's something kind of modern about those actors. And so Christopher Walken does feel kind of modern, but we're supposed to believe this is humanity of the future. So I just like to believe that there's people now that will continue to talk like Christopher Walken after he passes. And so in the year 10,000, they've become like a group of people that are now this imperial family.
Look, this is why I think that's incredible. And I think that maybe Denny kind of realizes too. It's crazy that people speak with a British accent in the sky. That doesn't make any sense. You know what I mean? So like, why can't people also have Bronx accents? You know, like why would there ever be someone speaking with, you know, it's a little strange. It's
always, you know what they should have done is should have had Florence Pugh speaking with the same, like, do a Christopher Walken impression. The same way that Austin Butler was doing a Stellan Skarsgård impression, because he really was.
He was talking like this, and I never really thought about how Stellan Skarsgård talks before.
It's a great, 100%.
It's like, oh God, he's Popeye, and I didn't realize it.
He's Popeye. It was a great impression. Like it was so good that I was like, oh, he could be related to him.
That said, though, he did slip into Elvis like once or twice.
Oh, yeah. He said Mama Baby at that one point. But then I was like, wait a minute. That's weird.
I'll never forget when he slayed that man and everybody clapped and he said, thank you very much. And he just.
I know. just and then when they said, Fade Rautha has left the building, it's like, okay, come on, guys. We get it. They're leaning into this now.
That movie was out of this world. Like, I really had a good time watching Dune with you guys. And, you know, whenever it comes home, looking forward to watching it with you again. But, like, man, was this was exciting. It just hit me like a ton of bricks. Like, it just, the action, the emotion of it, you know, it just was, it was great. And it was beautiful. It was beautiful. And I liked the shifts in color. Like, there was, like, that, when they were in this world that kind of created this, was it manufactured light? Was that supposed to be
or light? Supposed it to be the, just different sunlight.
This different sun, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, like a different sun. Oh, that was beautiful.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like really motivated. Cool. It was like made to look very like the kind, almost like a Zack Snyder sort of visual design aesthetic, but then like motivated by the idea of on this planet, this is how it would appear to you, you know? So that's just kind of interesting.
Even the cool idea, like when they have fireworks going off, it's like an ink blot exploding. Yeah. Like that shit was so cool, man.
Yeah.
Denny Villeneuve,
the silent floating down. I didn't mean to interrupt, but just another weird touch was like people silently floating rather than having like jetpacks that make a lot of noise. This weird, eerie kind of slow floating.
Quentin Tarantino, Denny, and I'd say Christopher Nolan are in like this like fuck you kind of way of making movies, like where they're like, I'm gonna make a scene that no one can replicate. It's like I've been seeing that more with these three directors. Like I love the dialogue driven stuff that Quentin does that I don't feel like can be replicated. I love the like, I was thinking about that backward scene in Tenet. Like, I didn't love that movie, but I've never seen anything like it. You know what I mean? It's
just like, no. So even if you, like, I feel like even Christopher Nolan haters are always curious about, like, exactly what they hate about the new one. And so they have to check it out because he has a concept, you know? This actually feels like a segue into Oscar talk, but we could.
Why don't we do that? That's fine.
Yeah, you want to just do it and then
stay with Oscars.
I mean, it seems right that Christopher Nolan has an Oscar for directing movies at this point.
Yeah.
It seems right that this is the movie that was the one that kind of broke the average or the five-way tie or whatever it could have been in your heart or your mind with some of these great movies that were up against each other this year. So this felt like an interesting year for me in that I was like, I couldn't really argue with any of the wins. And yet there were favorites maybe I had that I had hoped for that didn't win, but it wasn't like, and I didn't see that much amongst like reasonable, even-keeled people. I didn't see that much crazy division about how the awards went. There was a lot around. It seems like Emma Stone had the unenviable position of a lot of people thinking this was Lily Gladstone's year.
Right.
And you almost see it on her face for a second, like, oh, this is more complicated than if I didn't win. But yeah, I feel like right. a lot of people are also coming out saying, you know, no, she deserved it because she was great. And a lot of people even before this were saying it's a shame that Emma Stone is so good in Poor Things because they wanted it to be Lily Gladstone's year. So right. I don't know. I had personal favorites that didn't win, but more so than in almost any ceremony I can think of, there were so many wins where I was like, oh, cool, that won. Oh, that's a good win for that, you know. And I don't know if I would have picked an Oppenheimer sweep for my personal choices. When I looked at who won in each category, I didn't have any problem with it. I don't know. It was almost less interesting because of how much the awards were like, oh, that's fine. There's a lot of deserving movies this year.
Right. Yeah.
Anyway, what did you guys think?
Yeah, I thought it was a pretty good show. Like the production itself is always something like beyond who wins. Like I like to watch and kind of like have feelings about, because you know there's so many elements that people look forward to. Something that really has always bothered me and continues really to, because it's kind of like hit or miss, or they don't really do it for every category, or especially the ones that you would think they should. But like the clips especially for the acting categories. Like I'm a fan of clips, and yeah. I feel like, you know, the approach to this year, like having the past winners come, was a really cool thing.
Yeah.
And some of their conversation with the nominees felt really like genuine and like really great very funny. Like the Nicolas Cage, the Paul Giamatti one.
That was like my favorite moment of the whole night. Those two
right,
guys.
Like you can't replicate, like you want that kind of thing when you get that kind of talent involved. Yeah. Or like, you know, Rockwell to Downey, you could tell there were relationships happening in some of these deliveries, but some just felt very stale, very empty. Like, what's the cue card say? I can't really, you know what I mean? Like it was just kind of awkward. Yeah. So like that's something I wish they would kind of bring back and consistently have clips during the acting categories. Totally but overall, agree. I thought the show was like probably one of the more streamlined, clean shows. In a while, like a lot, like there was really not a lot that didn't work, like hard stop didn't work. You know, a lot of the jokes were pretty funny. You know, I think the I'm Just Ken performance, honestly, I feel like that's like an all time Oscar thing at this point. Like
one of the most confident things I've seen an actor do at an Oscar ceremony. Like when an actor who's up for an award has to get up and like perform, it can be sort of awkward. I feel like there was something, I mean, you know, like everybody, this seems to be like, oh, a four quadrant moment. Everybody sort of agrees that Ryan Gosling has like, that we like funny Gosling, and when he can absolutely. Lean into funny, and the fact that he played it so straight.
Everybody there was into it. Like everybody was standing, you know, they do this sing along as he walks past Emma, and like, it's just, that stuff was like, it was just infectious. Like you want that kind of energy.
Absolutely.
And you could tell that, like, that was a moment for the broadcast. But yeah, like, overall, that was all great. I really like John Mulaney's little thing he did where he basically recapped Field of Dreams instead of introducing his category.
Right.
I would love to see him have a shot at hosting the Oscars. I think he'd be great.
Did that feel like his audition or something?
It really did. It really did. But yeah, the winners, I agree with you. Like, I don't, there's not really something that won that I felt like, oh, that's crazy. Like that's a honest, you know what? I'll say the only thing, and I can't really speak fully to it because I didn't actually see The Boy and the Heron, but I'm like, I was shocked that Spider-Verse didn't win. Not shocked. I knew that Boy and the Heron had won a lot of other awards, but,
movies, man.
I know. It's like, I get it. Like it didn't, that's why I'm saying the shocked is not the right word, but I was kind of surprised that actually played through for that category. But yeah, overall, otherwise, I feel like it was pretty like just reward show. Like I felt like everything felt about right to me.
Yeah.
What about you, Ronald?
I think, man, you gotta respect the Mickey Mouse Club to Stardom pipeline that exists. I think that there's like a lot of like forgetting that he comes from, he's been doing this for a very long time. He's a showbiz kid. So yeah. Like, you know, it's like, I think that people are just discovering
he's like a trained
him.
Professional.
Yes. And has been doing it for decades. So like the version of him that we're seeing, I've known him for, I mean, I'm a Mickey Mouse Club guy. I mean, but yeah. Seeing this happen the
if
way
you were, I feel like you'd refer to it as MMC, but yeah. I'm just back up.
Look, are we getting into the newer one when they started calling MMC?
Same transition.
There's a difference. There's a difference. But yeah, I totally get you, man. Like, there's like this culture that I guess knew about him forever. That and I love that people are starting to, because we knew that he was funny for a long time. You know, it felt like the worst kept secret ever. And now seeing Barbie become this like new way to people for people to discover him is really cool. Shout out to Godzilla Minus One. Oh my God.
That's a good
one. You know, I'm always an advocate for Asian cinema, Asian representation. And it feels like it's happening more and more and more. You know, Past Lives didn't win anything, but at least it was nominated. You know, that to just be like, that's really cool. American Fiction getting
Best adapted, yeah, because it's based on a novel.
Shout out to Korg. It's just, and his speech. I mean, that's another thing, man. Yeah, like this,
he had a good
like,
moment too.
This feels like the wedding version of, man, I have this theory about weddings. Weddings aren't for the people that get married, and for everybody else. You kind of realize that when you're there, you just like, you know, the people, everybody's happy, but there's something about everybody else that's like, oh, I'm consuming these things that I don't necessarily have to pay for.
No, if you're throwing the wedding, you're much more concerned about how everybody else is doing. And if you're at the wedding, you're kind of, it's an excuse to sort of cut loose or whatever.
This feels like the most mainstream year for the Oscars, and I'm loving it. And it's all because of Barbenheimer, but mostly, let's be honest, because of Barbie. Mm-hmm. It there's something about the way that this was done, the pedigree of it, Greta Gerwig doing what she did in the way that she did it.
And she and Noah Baumbach obviously writing a very intelligent script that contained all this stuff. You know what I mean? That like
for sure.
It's accessible. Made it work. When people talk about that movie clicking, there's some conceptual framework that was just really smart.
Doing a lot of magic tricks. You know, and I think that's just the, you know how it is writing a script, man. Like the fact that they did this the way that they did it is nuts.
It's like they cracked it.
Yeah, they cracked the code. They cracked the code, and from everything from Frances Ha to this, I knew that she was capable of it. Yeah. It's cool to see it happen, and I still need to see Emma Stone's movie. I still haven't seen it. I need to sit down with it. My wife tried to start it up, turn it off immediately. She could. Anything that gets a little too like artsy. She gets a little like, she likes artsy, but there's certain kinds of artsy that she's just like, mutilated faces. And she's like, I'm out. She actually did it. And then she reached out. She's like, look,
she does a flourish. To start this up. She spins her head around. And then,
she was like, can I play the first 30 seconds for you? She played it. She went, ugh, and it turned it off. And it's like,
well,
I
especially
can't.
If she's not too big on Emma Stone, which you've confessed to me.
Yeah.
So it's like, you have to sort of be hooked into the idea of like, I'm going to take this crazy ride. But also, if you're a Yorgos Lanthimos fan, you already know this is kind of like his version of a kind of fable, fairy tale kind of feel. So it's going to be stylized plus stylized. You know what I mean? So it's a big ask. If that's going to be the thing that bothers you, it's like a lot of the movie is the style, I would say. But that's why you notice a lot of the awards it won were, you know, design and costume, and I think that it deserves that. Like if Oppenheimer's going to sweep, Poor Things kind of deserves to be noticed for the things it got noticed for. Certain things just made me feel good. It's, you know, I didn't realize how good I would feel to see Killian get one, but just he's been so good in so many things such a unique style of acting. And then you get to have that moment of realizing, oh yeah, Robert Downey Jr. didn't have one yet, right? Like this is it. This is his first.
Yeah.
That's crazy. So it's like a great movie for him to have had that. Like this isn't the total, that's what he won for? But it is a little bit of a, really, it took this long for him to win? But when you think about his career, you know, know, this is kind of the, this is the shoe-in, the closest to a shoe-in role, I think, that he's had for all the things he's been good in.
There's been this narrative that like Ryan Gosling was going to like charm everybody's pants off and then get a little further along. And then Robert Downey Jr. opened his mouth and kind of shut that down.
Yeah.
I'd like to believe that I'm just Ken created this like symmetry to it. Like, you know,
I think he did.
He really did. It's easy to look at somebody on screen and be like, man, that guy's charismatic, but does it transfer to, you know, IRL? And to see it happen the way that it did was like, everybody kind of shined. And even that Batman moment, man, that Arnold Schwarzenegger, Danny DeVito, and Michael Keaton moment.
Yeah, that was great.
My impression is that was a Danny DeVito pitch. I heard Michael Keaton talking about it in an interview, and I don't know whose idea it was, but he thought he was just doing the other thing. And he was like already leaving, you know, heading out. And then they grabbed him and were like, you know, we want you to do this other thing. And then he was like, what can I do quick? So he thought of like the ascot. He was like, if I'm going to be Bruce, I need to have like an ascot, which was perfect.
So
and then he was debating whether he should be talking to somebody next to him and then kind of turn and brush off the guys. But they said, no, the dead stare is what they wanted to do. But it was just cool hearing how improvised that gag was. And if it is indeed Danny DeVito's idea, it's hilarious that like the setup is him coming out there and then saying, there he is. That just cracked me up. It was so silly. Yes. And even the fact that that wasn't the Batman that Arnie fought.
Yes.
It made
just
me
play
think,
along with it,
but it made me think: does Arnold remember?
Does he remember that movie?
Do any of these three men remember who was in what movie?
He did.
It's like son of a bitch.
No, I love and the fact that he's like, oh, he's got a lot of nerve. That's so silly, but that was a fun moment. And Jimmy Kimmel held it down. I mean, he's not going to set your heart on fire, especially when you have someone like John Mulaney sitting there, who a lot of people are like, that's the right guy. But I feel like he's got the polish to pull it off, and a lot of people can't make those sort of mid jokes work, and he can kind of play them off with the right level. Like, he can come out and be a little bit acerbic, and it doesn't seem like, who are you? Because he's built relationships with so many stars the way that he handles his talk show. I think there's a lot of sort of showbiz love for him.
Speaking of him, man, I'm really sorry to hear the Olivia Munn news.
That's awful.
Super soon. It's terrible.
We talk about John Mulaney, the back and forth. So many people are in his personal life or in their personal lives on social media in a way that parasocial shit, people got really attached to the idea that he was this little teddy bear person. And when he started having rehab and divorce and people like, it's that weird. Isn't that weird though? Those fans that are like, the purity test. I've never had that attitude towards people I follow.
I don't know. I don't know. He's a human being, man.
Like, I know. Like doing bad things, I get. Like having a drug relapse and a failed marriage, that's not like a moral failure.
Right,
that's like
the kind
of shit that could happen to anybody and is happening to everybody.
And to fall into the arms of Olivia Munn is not an L, my friends.
Right.
I don't know.
And the back and forth about that, about whether, oh, did he leave her? And it's like, there's no evidence of that. People are just being, whatever. But it's sad to hear about her diagnosis and,
I don't know. Quick recovery, Olivia.
Yes. All right. Well, do we have anything else to say about Jan Oscars? I'm trying to think. You know, I do also think I'm glad that the Billie Eilish song won. I'm glad that I'm Just Ken got to have the cool moment of the night, because it was just a moment. It was like you said, Ronald, it was like that was Gosling's kind of reward for being this guy who's game for anything. But I think that I feel like the right song won. I've heard people say the wrong song won. I don't agree. I feel like the Billie Eilish song is so beautiful and there's a delicate quality to it, and every time I hear it I kind of go, oh yeah, even more than the movie, I like those two songs.
Totally.
Phineas and Billie Eilish are aliens. I don't understand how they're able to make the quality of songs that they make at the quickness that they're able to produce them. People make these hits every couple years, like typical musicians. Billie and Phineas are like pumping them out every year,
and there's really not anybody else like them on the pop landscape, you know.
Nobody.
Like, when she first came out, I wanted to slot her into a certain kind of pop star role that I quickly was like, oh nope, that's not it for this person. There is like a weird, an ethereal quality, and like the way she's so quiet. I don't know. It that performance was really powerful, and yet it also felt like it was going to fall apart at almost any moment. And I don't know how certain performers managed to pull that one off.
Yeah, she's amazing.
She is.
It's a great performance for sure.
We're both.
All right. Well, we'll take us into if Hollywood is our God, Steve, some might say that our God could be compared to other things.
Mm-hmm. Like a bullet?
You know.
Maybe.
Just off the top of your head, that feels like a fruitful analogy. Let's explore this.
If only one of us had picked a movie.
I know. I know. It would really tie
at
it together.
At least carrying that moniker. Yeah, yeah, yeah. yeah, so let's go over to our required viewing. This was my pick from last week. This is a movie called God is a Bullet. Came out last year, 2023. This is a 2-hour and 36-minute long epic, violent, cult revenge thriller.
Yeah.
Starring, like I mentioned last week, really what pulled me to it
was
Micah Monroe. I mean, I love her. She's been great amazing. In so many things. And she's great. Yeah. I think she's great in this.
She is.
Yeah, and you know, I mentioned like Nikolai Coster-Waldau. Is that his name? I can't remember.
Nikolai Coster-Waldau, yes.
Coster-Waldau. Jamie Lannister.
Yes.
for everyone else. January Jones, Jamie Foxx. Who else? Ethan Suplee, Jonathan Tucker, Brendan Sexton.
Our boy, Jonathan Tucker. Our
boy.
Friend
of the show. Yeah, just a really cool, big, eclectic kind of cast of people that you definitely recognize from a lot of things, if not, you know, that having their moments as stars on certain things, you know,
right.
Like, you know, Nikolai was in Game of Thrones and January was in Mad Men. And, you know, they've had moments on huge, huge TV shows or, you know, big movie platforms. But, you know, this was just one that like always kind of intrigued me. It was always kind of floating around. Should I watch it? Should I not? A couple of people that I had, you know, followed last year, like critics online had like honorable mentions for it at the end of the year. And honestly, the other thing that really kind of found interesting was that it was directed by Nick Cassavetes, who has a pretty what's the proper word, like
eclectic
a
journeyman. He's kind of a journeyman director,
all over the place kind of movie filmography.
Yeah, well, I think that's what you call a journeyman director, when it's like they take the gig, they get the project going, they don't really have a style that you associate with them, they don't really have a genre.
Right.
It's not like he can't get stars to be in his movies. I haven't looked at box office for a guy like that to see like how he hangs around, but somehow he manages to put projects together every few years or something. So, you know, there's something going on there. But yeah, it is one of those, how did I not hear more about this movie when you see the cast? You know what I mean? It's one of those that seems bigger than it must have been, because it slipped by, and I don't know if I heard a little bit about this, but actually not much.
Had you heard of it, Ronald, at all? Or
no,
never heard of it.
Okay, you know, it's funny, I saw a still of Jamie Foxx's skin.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, yeah.
But I didn't know what the movie was associated with. I thought that like it was some Netflix movie or something that I made. Like, did I miss something? Like,
how did you read into that as that skin condition? Because as someone with vitiligo, it's most pronounced on my hands. It's just coming up in other spots.
Yeah.
I was like, is that supposed to be vitiligo? Because if so, the makeup, it looked like makeup. Like they didn't do a good job of making it look like skin. But then I thought, is he a guy who just got curious tattoos? Because like, and then I thought, are we supposed to, he has like, he's missing a hand. So then it made me think, did he have some kind of injury? And that's like supposed to be like his skin healed up and the scars didn't return to the natural tone. I just didn't know how we were supposed to read into that. But as a representation of vitiligo, I was like, they could have done a better job with the makeup if that's what that's supposed to be. But I didn't know if we were supposed to know. Did you have an opinion about what was going on with his kind of white splotches all over his face and skin?
I did not.
Yeah,
I've seen like what's her name? That model, that her skin's kind of like that.
Yeah, well, she's got vitiligo. I mean, that's pretty.
Yeah, yeah. But I guess it looks kind of similar to Jamie Foxx's His was just completely white, though.
Right. It was as though they put paint and it just looked like it was on his skin. So it didn't look like the lack of pigment. Saying. I just wondered, was that just a makeup that was supposed to be the lack of pigment? And then our cameras, our resolution is too good for something like that to trick us. Because it looked like, it seems like a character choice they would go with in this kind of movie is like, everybody's got to be so kind of like freaky and fucked up to say like, oh, let's do Jamie Foxx with vitiligo, you know?
Because the vitiligo combined with the hook.
With everything, right. Right, and he's a tattoo artist.
And you're a tattoo artist, and you
just got to keep piling it on, you know? It's like...
Yeah. And you like to roll coins.
Everybody went around the table. It's like one of the Key and Peele skits. It's like everybody went around the table, like, you pick something.
Yeah,
And what? Yeah. Oh, he's got a hook. And he's a tattoo artist. Yeah. And he rolls coins. Like, let's just build this guy out. I love it. It's like,
good God. Yeah, it was crazy sauce.
What did you guys think of the movie overall?
I could easily have thought this was one of the worst movies I've ever seen in my life. But something worked about this movie that I was just like, you know what it is? It feels like if this is based on a true story, Jesus Christ. I mean,
I think it's really fishy. The true story thing is very, like, if you look at what it says at the end, it's like elements of this story were pulled from things that have been said to have happened. But it might be that it's trying to get away from legal problems. I don't know. Yeah. But it seems like it's one of those, I would take that with a whole shaker of salt. Yeah.
Well, it just makes me think about this whole idea. Like, people are very scared of the rapper Lil Nas X and his worship of the devil. This version is like what people are really afraid of. This, like, not a gay man dancing with the devil. It's like this version of Satanism that's in this movie is the one that people are really afraid of. The ones that are like in Netflix documentaries and stuff.
But like the Satanic Panic version of, like, you know what they reminded me of? Have you ever seen like a Death Wish movie or that kind of movie? Yeah. Like, you know how street gangs act in those movies? just like amoral animals that are going around like knocking old ladies down and having their way with them and stuff. And I feel like this. The evil gang felt like that. Like, they're just so evil. Like, everything about them was just scummy and rotten and evil. Yeah. And you got some interesting actors in there. So some of it worked on like a scene by scene level and like this movie's crazy kind of level. But I have a thing with that kind of subject matter where it's like, if you're going to have like sexual assault and you're going to have this kind of abuse and trauma and stuff, there's two ways you can handle it in a movie. You can either earn it by treating it seriously with the weight that it should have and think about the perspective of it, or you can go like full exploitation route and go like B-movie schlock, and this movie almost like was like in both worlds.
Absolutely.
And I think that it's a tough thing to do, to expect us to care about the real human emotions of characters, even if the acting is good, or at least if the actors are bringing personal charm to it. Because I do think that Nikolai and
Micah, they
did bring like, they elevated this sometimes very on-the-nose kind of script and made some of their moments work. And in fact, the closing moments of the movie that really have you dealing with like their friendship. You know what, I was calling this movie, they should have called this movie The Young Woman with the Neck Tattoo. Because it was sort of, a sideways girl with a dragon tattoo kind of thing, where the real hook, if you're going to get hooked into it, is the unlikely sort of, not just partnership, but sort of by the end, like real love for each other that these two characters have that go on this journey. And it reminded me of the characters in Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. But it's a, like a pulpier version. And so I kind of think this movie either wanted to be more like moody and more of a character study, or it wanted to be more like Mad Max kind of going on against this gang. And I felt like the tonal bumpiness made me think, as I often think when a movie's 2.5 hours, I was like, is there like a secret like 90 minute version of this movie that would be like a blast, whether it was a pleasant, we can talk about how unpleasant some of the stuff that happens in this movie is, you know, separately, but just as far as like, if that was clearly the intention, was to take you there and be unpleasant, this puts this movie in that kind of category of like not so violent movies, where, you know, the punches to the face. I'm very sensitive to that punch to the face where it looks like it breaks your nose and blood's getting out everywhere. That happens to Micah too many times in this movie, man. That was upsetting me.
Smashing her head into things. Like, there's a lot of like...
So violent, yeah.
Micah's selling it like...
She's doing a great job.
Visceral, like...
Yeah, she's great.
Yeah, there's like a point where like that particular hit that you're talking about, it's like I had like
makes your head hurt watching it.
Yeah, it makes your head hurt. And then she's like trying to catch her breath while blood is still
holding her nose. Yeah.
Yeah, it just God, man, it's so really well. I think I kind of feel the way you feel about her. Like everything she's in, she brings it. And Nicolai, yeah, really, you know, for whatever problem we had with his accent.
Oh, I didn't even really have a problem with it. I just think there were a couple moments where it slipped into that, like,
oh yeah,
like, oh, it's like he's from Anytown, USA. You know, like it's one of those aspects of the movie that's just not very developed. But I love how he looked so much like Gary Oldman in the Christopher Nolan Batman film.
Yes,
and I love that performance. And I was like, okay, this is just like Jim Gordon on a side mission.
That's true, man.
I liked it. I liked it a lot. I thought that there were just it felt like a video game. Like that, it felt like they were going. But I think the torturing was bothering me. The stacking up things, like you can't have sexual assault and then stitching somebody's mouth and then, you know, stabbing them in the chest with a car and then stabbing them in the side. It's just like.
And then the domestic violence of between what's his name and January Jones was maybe the most gruesome.
What kind of abuse? That was like, and he was like, and he's not a small guy. He's like pounding her head and she can't defend her. It's just like, what is this?
That's kind of like, I think John was getting at it before. And I think that's would probably be my biggest. I actually thought I liked this movie quite a bit. Like I did, but I did feel like
I hate that I like this.
It felt a lot like, and I guess like Cassavetes, that whole like, I think he's got like a pull towards, you know, that character driven or like more of an art house kind of like look to some of his movies. Like I specifically thinking about like Alpha Dog has that in it a lot, and which I really like that movie too. But I think that kind of like. Indecision of like what this movie was going to be, I think is what obviously pushes it to 2 hours and 36 minutes, which it has no need to be at all. And I feel like honestly, like the best part of the most exciting part of the movie was like the whole like rescue piece, you know, like if that was like tighter or really kind of focused more on that, because that's really kind of where everything hits and gels and that's like, it's just propulsive, you know, at that point. And not that I don't like all the character stuff, because again, I think they're, especially the two leads, like they're really good in the movie. And, you know, and even the people that are in the cult, like I think they're all like just completely horrible and like just,
I mean, if you're going to play those kind of scumbags, it's like it's massive scumbag, like they all pull it off.
Yeah, like
in a kind of scary way. Like Ethan Suplee is kind of scary.
Yeah, you know?
Yes.
Like I you know, within 10 minutes of watching the movie, you know, you have a scene where they're like stealing a kid at a shopping center, which is frightening.
Yeah.
It's frightening.
Like, and even the music it's set to, and it's like there's no dialogue, you know, it's just that was horrible. And then the next 5 minutes you're seeing what happens to his ex-wife and their, you know, the daughter.
Mm-hmm.
Like it's those people are scary, like very scary.
Yeah.
And that happens in the first 10 minutes of the movie. So I like that. I like the introduction and immediately to know that like this is a force and like the idea of like, can he match that? Like how far is he willing to go? Like that revenge plot really kind of is where I kick in and what's kind of pulled me to this movie. But,
you know, I also want to give it credit, Steve, for in the last hour or so, I think that they did a pretty good job with, and because I may not have liked this movie, like, and might have even issues with it on a certain level, but also thinking like, I'm always interested in this kind of movie, these kind of batshit movies, like the movie that made me think of, not that it's like it at all, and I actually think The Counselor, the Ridley Scott film, is a better movie, but it's also crazy, and it's like got violence and like awful things happening, and you have to wonder what's the point of the way all the violence is kind of stacking up. But you know, this also kind of follows almost like a noir, like a road movie, revenge kind of story, like you're talking about. So what I actually thought the movie did a great job with was the part where they're going too far,
right?
And the movie doesn't really stop and comment on it and like make it seem like, see, I told, there's no like cute dialogue around like,
yeah,
this is the moment that you've crossed the line. There was no, it was just too far to come back. Yeah. You feel it. And then like, therefore at the, when you get to sort of the end of the film and you're more looking at their mental state and how maybe they're the only two that kind of understand each other. I felt like I bought that more than I would have expected to. When I was, if you told me in the first half, the last half of this movie, the main thing you're going to care about is the status of their friendship, sort of, you know, and like, can they save each other from the darkness that they're jumping into?
Exactly.
As much as saving the daughter is important, it's less involving to you emotionally somehow in the last part of the movie, because they feel, I feel like they do a smart job of like, let's get the daughter out of there and then let's deal with like the fallout with these characters. I bought that more than I expected to. Like, so in some ways I think that it worked on me, and I do think sometimes it's actors and tone that might pile up and work on you, but like, I think that stuff was more effective than I would have expected it to be. I did want to the as far as like the gangs, the kind of craziness of the gang, though, I do think that some of the you know, some of the stuff that I was thinking about most when watching this movie, especially when I was talking to you guys or getting ready to talk to you guys, was, you know, Jonathan Tucker, like, whatever you want to say about this movie and this kind of thing, he's a perfect example of why I think actors do this kind of thing, because like, he's never gotten to play this kind of weird, flamboyant, like whiny, crazy, weaselly asshole. I mean, you keep thinking, I thought he was about to get killed about 18 times in this movie before it happens. And I think that like, that must be fun for an actor like Jonathan Tucker, who maybe he didn't get to be in like the Scorsese crime epic or the Ridley Scott movie or whatever. Maybe that'll still come for him, but to get, you still see this kind of part and go, oh, this is like meaty in a weird, sweaty, muscular way that I think must be fun for the performers to pull off. Even like we said, even though it's like very unpleasant material. What do you guys think of Jonathan Tucker as Errol?
I enjoyed him. You know, it was crazy watching him kind of flail around when he got pressed by the group.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, what did he do wrong? I can't figure out what he did wrong either. Like, I think, because he's a weasel and he's like a suburban kid that came to this gang.
Well, I guess he owns that place that they're in, but it's like, it's a little unclear until you see where he's living that he's actually pretty powerful, you know.
Yeah,
I guess that's why they don't just kill him, is because he has some right to kind of yell at them. But we're like, when Ethan Suplee showed up, I thought the power dynamic was different than what it really was. Like, you know, I thought he was about to crack heads, but he was just a henchman kind of. Anyway, you know, interesting and, you know, fun in that way that like a sweaty late Oliver Stone movie can be, where it's just a lot of overacting, a lot of, you know, but towards this kind of heightened mood, like, you know, of the intensity that you're kind of talking about, Steve.
Yeah, my big takeaway with Jonathan Tucker is just like, why don't I see more Jonathan Tucker?
Right.
Yeah.
You know, like I actually, when I was watching it, I pulled up his IMDb and I was like, what has he got going on?
Right. And what's like, he doing now?
This is his last credit and all he has. Like, he doesn't have any upcoming, you know, titles or like, he had a podcast series last year called the Montauk Caves, a TV miniseries called Echoes, and he finished out Westworld. But I mean, Westworld finished out. He was on Westworld.
Right.
But he like, yeah, like this
finished it.
Right. Yeah. This is like the last feature that he has on his IMDb. Like, what is going on, Jonathan? Maybe we should have him on a podcast again. And
but
just
to
get
say,
a,
you know,
just get a, sure. let's get a temperature check on him and see what's going on.
Yeah, man.
The Tucker temp.
The Tucker temp.
He did promise us crab cake. So,
yeah. And that can't have been just a nice thing to say to a bunch of guys that were in Baltimore, right?
Never, never. No, no one would do that.
He would never.
Yeah. I thought it was a great pick, man. Like, I thought I was going to dislike this movie.
That's a win for me.
It was so weird and
especially
gross.
After my last weird pick.
Yeah,
I feel like it set you back again. It was like, oh, but I actually like this one. Good.
I'd rather watch something weird and off-putting and interesting and full of actors and have more to talk about than just a nice movie. But, you know, nice movies are good.
I'm for sure.
For this feature, I think interesting beats nice in my estimation.
All right.
Well, I'm up next, and I guess I'll double back around to Oscar talk, because when the level-headed people on Twitter, I don't know if you guys are still popping in on Twitter, but there's the film Twitter folks. There's a lot of division about every movie topic, and there was a flashpoint of those things around the Oscar discourse, and so there was a lot of really vitriolic discourse out there. And someone that I follow on Twitter said that the Twitter discourse around movies in the Oscars was giving us a preview of election year discourse, and election, like the weird division over small differences and weird people just raring to argue about something they love that they, if you don't love it just like them, then you're their enemy. And, right. And so we were kind of, and I sort of agreed with what they were saying, that is, it felt like people were firing up their pitchforks. I said firing up the jacuzzi full of vomit early, you know. But yes, much nicer to say firing up your torches. It's an easier image to process. But it made me think about the fact that we are in an election year. And so I looked to my list, and there's a film that I have long wanted to watch. I think I may have seen this once when I was a young man and it was on television. But we're going back in time to 1957 for a political satire that is about like a drifter who is sort of plucked from obscurity by I think it's a radio producer when she meets him and thinks that he's got like a certain kind of charm that people might like on the air, and this drifter becomes famous and powerful and takes his fame and uses it as a backdoor into a political career. And it's a satire that people frequently talk about, especially in our recent age where someone might go from being a reality show host to being president. So A Face in the Crowd, the movie that was Andy Griffith's first movie from 1957, written by Bud Schulberg, who wrote On the Waterfront, the Brando film, and directed by Ilya Kazan, who directed that movie, amongst other things. If you look at Ilya Kazan's resume, you'll see a lot of classic films. Anyway, this is a movie that I know is supposed to be great, and I remember watching enough of it to see that it was interesting and great. And also, it's like Andy Griffith before, like a couple of years after this is when he would appear on television and start to develop his kind of homespun Andy Griffith character, or Sheriff Andy Taylor was not out there yet. This was when he was just an actor who had been in a, I think he was known for a theatrical career, No Time for Sergeants, I believe, was the play that he was known for. Anyway, so this will be a fun opportunity to see like a star before their persona is forged. So he's just appearing in this as an actor. But also, it's a story that when you hear about the broad strokes of it, it sounds like a really smart political satire that is relevant, perhaps, to our present day. So A Face in the Crowd from 1957. It's out there to be rented. I didn't see anybody that's playing it that's just part of a regular subscription, but I think this is, you know, this is kind of a classic film that people will refer to a lot, so it might be worth the rental fee. Face in the Crowd.
I'm absolutely, I'm excited. I've never heard of it, and I'll watch the hell out of it.
Sounds good. Yeah, I was checking. It's just like, it's just rental everywhere, no streaming.
Rental everywhere.
The I'm just looking at the poster. The tagline on the poster is, it says, "Power. He loved it. He took it raw in big gulpfuls. He liked the taste, the way it mixed with the bourbon and the sin in his blood."
Damn.
Bud Schulberg's A Face in the Crowd. So yeah.
Oh my God.
They knew how to write a tagline back then.
Yeah. Holy moly guacamole. That was intense.
So Ronald, our next feature is Manhunt, the series on the Apple TV Plus. You were the one who mentioned, actually both episodes, the first two episodes of this show dropped today, the day that this podcast comes out, March 15th, that is. So we had a chance to preview them. So we've seen them a little bit in advance. What made this show cross your path, and that made you think of it as a possible topic for the show?
I thought it was interesting that it was like, of course, about the murder of Lincoln, but yeah. it's done more like a murder mystery. You know, I'd never mm-hmm. thought about that approach, like a murder mystery. And because of that, some of the subsequent motivations that may have sparked his assassination. I mean, it becomes very clear even from the trailer why, you know, it became so hard to find this man, John Wilkes Booth.
Right, right.
But some of the intricacies of it, and I don't know how deep the research went in this. It seems really interesting just how elusive he was. So yeah, that's what kind of brought it to my attention. What I was very skeptical about, I mean, I'm a black guy.
I know how you feel about period pieces. So I was thinking about you when I was watching these two episodes.
How much are they going to approach? Because period pieces can do two things. It's kind of like the whole shogun thing. You can make a choice. You could be like, are we going to acknowledge racism but not put the N-word in it?
Right.
Or are we going to do all of it together? Which is, you know, I feel like for accuracy's sake, maybe that works more. Just so people know how it felt for people back then. But this combines a lot of it. I mean, I feel like Apple's really gone for it. Like the feel of that time, how, you know, fresh off of slaves being freed, how people were resistant to the idea of it. I mean, to
like
say
openly resistant, like openly to, resistant. Like to a person's face, meeting somebody. Yes. And like being openly like mad at them that they're free, you know, like that's what you're catching in this show. That's
a very weird. And then going to free states and trying to do that too, like it's just like what?
Right. Well, being like, oh, it's really too bad. I can't own you, and like that kind of shit. Yeah. Where it's just like, holy shit, this is cold. I think that the main thing I took from that, Ronald, that I had never thought about before, and I think the show really makes it clear. And I think focusing on Edwin Stanton. Played by Tobias Menzies, who's great in this, honestly.
He's really good.
If you love him and you've kind of wished for him to have a vaguely heroic character that you can actually hang in there with. Like a competent lead. He's frequently plays sort of like the guys that get shunted off to the side or whatever. Seeing the way he has to consider like that this could be a new war. Like they've just made peace.
Yeah.
They've just restored union to the United States to say, like, what if this is a sign that peace is so fragile that it won't hold? And to be the sort of point man for that, that's something I never really had thought about, like, in terms of what it must have felt like to try to figure out what was going on. And then that question of, is the Confederacy still actively acting and bankrolling this? That's like the question that's the real hook, I think, of the kind of mystery that you're talking about. Because we obviously know who did it and we kind of see what they're doing, but watching how they start to, even in the first two episodes, they're starting to draw a little bit of a circle around how they might find out, you know, or find this person who a lot of people want to protect. A lot of people are proud of what he did and think that it's, you know, that very disunion that is a frightening thing for the government to ponder. Like there's people in that want that. So I don't know.
Yeah,
I feel like
pulling them closer.
Just how fragile it all was and fragile it all is. We feel that today. It's interesting to realize, yes, the war had been won. Lincoln had been killed, the symbol of, you know, our country that so many people found valuable. And it was already something that was being potentially torn down. I think that catching history in that moment is an interesting place to set the story, but it's an interesting little piece of the story to focus on.
Yeah, for sure, man. What'd you think, Steve?
It's interesting. Like I for a second, I thought I didn't watch the second episode, but I was just checking and I did. I was like, I watched it so quick when you said, hey, let's watch these. I was like, did I watch both? I forgot.
Right.
I don't know. I feel like I was. I'm definitely interested in continuing the show. I feel like I don't want to. I don't know. I don't know if this is a spoiler. It's not intended. Like the show starts off with the assassination, right? So basically, that's the jumping point. Yeah. I feel like through two episodes, I don't personally know if that was the right decision. I feel like when you said let's check it out, I watched the trailer. And I felt like the hunt, the chase, the trying to find the kill, like it really
the
plays
manhunt?
Up. Yeah, the manhunt, I think is what you'd call it. The trailer really plays that up, and
you know,
I
didn't think
much
about that title, but they're hunting for a man.
That's what it is. Goddamn, we're so smart at Apple. I guess what I'm trying to say is, like, I feel like starting it like that, instead of building up to it and then letting the chase happen on the back half.
because it's only 7 episodes.
Right.
Yeah.
But like for something that took 12 days in real life to be 7 episodes of television, it's like maybe you have something going on before that, like the build to the assassination.
Like maybe just an episode or something where that ends with the assassination rather than, because I kind of know what you mean. The flashback structure is like the thing that works for me the least about the show is the jumping back and forth.
Yes.
I kind of was thinking if they did this linearly, I did the math in my head. Would I like this better if they did it linearly? And I think I would.
Yes, me too.
But I also think it would have done the thing you're talking about, which meant we would have had an episode of Lincoln scenes up front, at least the most of an episode to have what's happening in the country. Because I got a little, not confused, but just like exasperated with the 10 minutes before the assassination, 3 days after these. Like sometimes when that just feels random, it makes me think, there's not really like a rhyme or a reason to it. Like, why are we seeing flashbacks? Why is it structured this way? You know, other than just like narrative convenience to say we're going to start with a bang, and which is what they did.
And I think that takes away like any sense of dread going into the event.
Yeah,
you know, like, and I think that if that was used as a building point when it happens, like the chase, you know, the moment that like really is what the show is probably getting at or getting to. I feel like if you did that over like 4 or 5 episodes instead of literally 7 with these dramatic flashbacks building out the moments before, I don't know. Just something about that just feels like, I don't know. Maybe I hope I'm wrong. Maybe as we watch more,
right?
But like, I don't like 5 more episodes of like the tension being drawn out.
Yeah.
That's a tall order, I think.
Especially if they're going to try to dip back into more flashbacks with Lincoln to give us juice, because that feels like an odd, it makes that performance as Lincoln feel even more kind of like separate from the rest of the show.
Yeah. And he's already great.
It takes you like a scene to grasp.
He's so good.
But then once you realize, like for me, it was like once I realized who I'm watching and what they're bringing to it, I was just like, I want to be charmed by this guy. And maybe I want to hang out with him a little bit longer. So it doesn't feel like a kind of sketch impression, you know, which is not what he's doing, but you know what I mean. When you just get a little dose, it feels like this is like a concentrated dose of Lincoln being charming. I mean, then you go back to a story where it's like the whole point is that we're about to watch him get killed. Yeah. I do think the way that they staged the assassination was really effective. You know, by hanging out with John Wilkes Booth and seeing like his view and
the curtain,
you're sitting there almost thinking, is he going to chicken out? I hope he chickens out. You know, like in that moment, you feel the decision open to him not to do it. And then you realize how easy it was to get close to him. And then it's over. Like it's one little shot. And then I feel like I've seen that moment in my mind so many times that seeing it depicted, honestly, I guess I've just seen photos or drawings
of
what it looked like. Because do you know what I mean? I felt like I'd seen it in my mind, and it felt like it was like a famous moment from Shakespeare or something like that that I was watching, because I know that moment. I know that I know what he screams, and I know that he breaks his leg, and I know that he kind of runs off while the crowd is still shocked and all that stuff, you know.
The dread that you're talking about, the dread you're getting at, John, and the dread that Steve was talking about earlier, and it's, you have to understand, listeners, that when you watch someone get their brains blown out, it's weird to watch that and the way that they handled it, and him being in like beds, you know, the doctors being bedside, the blood being on the, and the sounds that it's making as
like the squishing sounds when they move his head. That was grim.
Then to go from that to like hearing the squishing sounds, 2 seconds later he's upright, alive, and talking to people in his political circle is a jarring thing to take in.
Did I ever tell you about the little girl and the raisins? Like, you know, and he's like this super charming uncle.
That's the thing that like is kind of messing me up a little bit.
Disjointed.
It's jarring, man.
Yeah, it's very jarring, disjointed. I feel like like the linear. And Lincoln Ladder is great, and I love him, and I like seeing him in anything. Plays Lincoln. Sorry.
Well, no, I just mean like people on the show may know we love him from Midnight Mass and many other things. But he's such a great guy. I loved him in Legion too. He was really good on that show.
Oh, yeah. I've never watched Legion. I watched one episode and then I never.
I feel like it's a great show, but it's wackadoo. I mean, it's the fun kind of crazy, but it's definitely crazy.
Yeah,
check it.
But yeah, I don't know. I mean, maybe again, like I'm definitely going to continue watching the show because I mean, I like the cast and it's an intriguing idea for a series. But
to structure it like a procedural, this thing from history that we know is smart idea. Wow.
Yes, absolutely. Like, what was the one? I don't think many people even watched it. I think we talked about it briefly on the podcast, but it was The Pale Blue Eye. Did you guys watch that?
Is that the one about John Brown?
With Christian Bale.
That's the one that was the one that was Poe, right? Yeah,
the Poe story that was on Netflix like last fall.
I never watched it. I remember
same kind of thing. Like it's like procedural detective, thing, with this historical kind of story, which I thought. I mean, I actually quite liked that quite a bit.
One thing I want to mention about Manhunt that it took me a minute to realize who I was looking at. I did not recognize Glenn Morshower as Andrew Johnson until I was like, who is that? Because I'm not used to seeing him with hair on his head. But I was like, I know I love this actor. He's always good. I first noticed him on 24 years ago. But Glenn Morshower is one of those that guy character actors who's like always good. But he doesn't do one kind of thing, or he kind of does one kind of thing. I don't know. Look at what he's played and what he's done. But I think he's doing some really good work as Andrew Johnson, who's honestly one of the more interesting characters because there's a morally ambiguous quality to him. Because as you're sorting out the mystery and you're wondering if there are factions within the government that might have supported this attempt, the idea that the guy who's now president, who was vice president, he might be part of it. It's it's and nuts. Also like as a political enemy potentially of Lincoln was known for working with and running with and like bringing people into his inner circle that he didn't agree with. And so the notion that he could have had, some kind of that Andrew Johnson is not like in the clear as far as the investigators are considered. I think that Glenn Morshower does a great job of playing that kind of seems like a good man on a certain level, but also seems like he could be a player and part of this attempt to maybe overthrow the government. It's an interesting performance. And then I think Larry Pine, who plays the Seward, is another actor that I didn't recognize in this movie or in this show until I looked him up. And I was like, oh yeah, that guy. But like, I think that there are some good character turns in this. So if that's another fun part of this show, if you're as Steve, if you're disjointed, if you're feeling a little put out by the structure of it, and I kind of was too, you might still enjoy it's Patton Oswalt with a big beard. It's Matt Walsh from
Don't Forget Patton.
And like a lot of
Patton
great
saying Lickety Split. I was like, oh, okay, this is the Patton I love.
Yeah.
Lickety Split.
Well, all right. That's pretty much a show, right?
Anything else you guys saw you want to mention before we wrap it up?
No, I don't think so.
I gotta admit to I watched I can't remember if it was on Hulu the Ricky Stenicki.
How is it?
I liked it, man. I'm a mark for a dumb R-rated comedy. Like,
okay, now is this not a movie? I just watched the trailer, and then I heard someone say it was kind of funny. Is this not a movie that in the 90s would have had like a few weeks of everybody talking about it and quoting? Yeah. I mean, like,
and it would probably have a sequel greenlit already,
right? I mean, like it's a Farrelly honestly, brothers, or it's a one of the Farrelly
one
brothers,
of the, right? It's Peter Farrelly, yeah.
So I mean, that's a pretty sure hand to have on your kind of throwback, like, comedy like this. I don't know. I saw it and I was like, yeah, this just is the wrong era somehow for this movie, and I could totally see it being funny with that cast and with that concept, which is it's such a high concept thing, but it also seems like the kind of thing that would lead to gags. That would be pretty funny. Him pissing his pants and them seeing it and him saying, oh, it's not what you think. It's just piss.
Just piss.
It's like the John Cena thing. It's like, we like him now. I like to see how game he is. I thought he was funny at the Oscars too. He's just,
he's game. He's so much fun to watch in this. I mean, interestingly enough, I think like Zac Efron's definitely probably the weak link of the movie, like, which I thought he was great in Iron Claw, and like he's been in his fair share of these kinds of comedies before, but I honestly felt like specifically like Andrew Santino.
I was about to say, how's he?
I love him, man.
I love his timing. Funny.
He's so funny, man. He's so funny. But yeah, and what was the other guy's name? Jermaine Fowler.
Yeah, yeah.
Plays the other
DC's own.
Right. Yeah. Oh, really? I didn't know that.
It's from DC.
Okay. Who played Urkel in what was the movie that he was the killer? What was that movie called?
Black.
The Blackening?
The Blackening.
Yeah, he played Urkel in that.
Yeah, he was Urkel.
He's so good. But yeah, I thought this movie was very funny. I mean, it's so stupid and it's like super high concept, but yeah. William H. Macy's in it, having fun, you know. But yeah, Cena is like kind of the price of admission here. Like he's just like all in being so dumb and fun. And yeah, honestly, like you saying like 90s, early 2000s, like this is that kind of comedy. It's, and I just double check. It's actually Amazon Prime is right. What it's on. But yes. Yeah, I would say go ahead and watch that if you like those kinds of comedies and you're not, you're not looking for anything crazy, but just kind of like right down the line, late 90s, early 2000s, R comedy. With a lot of funny people in it, you know, like it's just it really works. I thought, but I found myself laughing more than I thought I would simply off the trailer. But yeah, that's on Amazon Prime right now.
I'll just throw out there that I watched Last Voyage of the Demeter finally, which is also on Amazon. Or I guess maybe it's on Paramount and you can watch it on Amazon. Anyway, I think that's where I saw all the Ricky Stenicki ads was when I was watching Mr. and Mrs. Smith and when I was watching Last Voyage of the Demeter.
Voyage, yeah.
But I don't know. I think this is one of those movies that Last Voyage of the Demeter, that is, where it's like I knew at the time that if this movie was really some great gem, I would have heard that buzz from some of my people that see everything that are more, you know, into this kind of genre thing. But I also knew that if it totally stunk, I would have heard that buzz too. Right, and I never heard either bits of those buzz. And watching it, it's kind of exactly that. There is something, is like a better, more fun version of this concept where they have the same cast and the same production value. It's a cool movie. It's a great, if you're going to look for like a new Dracula story to tell, the little chapter that doesn't really get told is his journey from across the sea or from, you know, elsewhere in Europe, from Transylvania basically to London, where most of Dracula takes place, is sort of like, that's a cool little part of the story. Yeah. That's like just a chapter and you hear about the ship's log and you hear about, like, you get the idea that there was a ship full of people and there is no people left when the ship makes it to land. That's a scary idea. Yeah, I think the movie is a little too dry in a way. Like I kind of liked how straight the movie played it, but then there's a point where it's like, this is a little too dry. It wasn't giving me, like, I kept thinking like if a Sam Raimi or somebody like that had this concept, maybe it would have been like more of a ride and less of just kind of, like, it's biding time with that idea that you already have in your head, which is that no one makes it out alive. And so you start to think, how could anyone survive this? And you start to see how there might be a way on or off this situation. But I don't know. It definitely never dipped into being, like, terrible. And it never was, like, cheesy or anything. I think some of the shots of the way they envision Dracula are really nicely creepy. Some of them looked a little goofy. But even that, it's, like, pretty much right down the middle, this movie is very much... It's very much like bare minimum what it needed to be, but it's just good enough in a few spots that you can't help but say, you should probably see it if this sounds like your bag at all. You know, it's the ultimate wait for it. You know, back when we used to have our three level scale of go ahead, wait for and hold up. this is the ultimate wait for it. Like it's perfect if you can watch it on a streaming thing and you can kind of maybe, you know, take a break, go get some more snacks or whatever. I think it would have been effective on a big screen, but it's a perfect sort of, watch it at home. You can pet your dog and go back to the movie. I don't think you will have missed much. Great cast though. And I think part of the fun really is watching a couple of these character actors get a chance to play slightly larger roles than they normally would get to. Like, I never know how to say his name. David, Destmalchian.
He's
pretty good in this, playing a different sort of character. Yeah. And then also the guy from Game of Thrones who played now I feel like I should have this movie pulled up so I can say the actor's name. The guy, we love him on Game of Thrones. What's his name?
I know you're talking about. I'm trying to remember.
Davos is the character's name. Or Davos, Lord Davos.
Davos, yeah.
It is... Liam Cunningham as Captain Elliot. It's fun to see him in this movie, but even he seems like he could have gotten more to do. Like he could have gotten to do a little bit more crazy stuff, but yeah, decent. Nice atmosphere.
Glad you finally got to check that out.
Yeah, finally did it. And that's a show.
Ronald, that anything, is a show. Sorry, I got distracted. I got all these alerts that reviews are coming out of South by Southwest about Alex Garland's Civil War. It premiered mm-hmm. tonight. Oh. Like glowing shit. Like,
really?
Like masterpiece stuff. Like, yeah.
Fall Guy's been getting great reviews too. So that's like yeah, two that, like that's exciting so, kind of mainstream movies to me. Like so did
Roadhouse.
Oh really? Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it did. I saw one.
I can't wait for us to get access to that, man.
I don't know, maybe. I mean, I would say fingers crossed because that platform gives us a lot of stuff. So
mm-hmm. bless their hearts.
Let's hope they give
it all. Give us all of it. If you're a platform Please. And you're listening to the show, give us all of it.
We got to talk about what's her name too. The second half of Invincible, right? Like I felt like
it just came back. Yeah.
Yeah.
Today. Yeah. Just started today with the day we're recording this, the 14th. Yeah.
Oh, I should mention this. There's a documentary that I've had a chance to be part of the. I did an engineering session for some voiceover stuff for this. There's a local dance teacher and acting. Well, she teaches in the acting department at the school where I teach as well. But her name's Maria Broom. She's an actress and teacher. And there's a documentary called Viva Maria that's being made about her. And they've just released a GoFundMe. Just check out the trailer. I mean, it definitely it will come across what the kind of person that Maria is. And also, if you listen to the trailer, you'll hear the voiceover stuff that I engineered. It was really kind of cool. Like I just did like a session.
That's cool.
With her reading her like remembrances from her life, knowing that she was going to turn the recordings over to the documentary directors that they could use it in the movie as like, you know, to stitch together anything they don't have interviews or whatever for. And just hearing it like in the trailer was really cool. But also I feel like this might be a really interesting documentary about a very interesting creative spirit. So look for Viva cool. Maria out there.
Viva Maria.
Very cool. Yeah. All right. Reminder next week, John, your required viewing
face in the crowd.
Yeah. And moviesmovie.com is the website. You can go there to listen to past episodes and subscribe on your favorite podcast platform for upcoming episodes. We also have a youtube.com/moviesmoviepod if you'd prefer to watch and listen to your podcast. You can subscribe and hit the notification bell to get alerts of when the new episodes drop there as well. We will be back next week to say hey once again. As always, you made our day. Thanks.